I was one of two Black nurses in an inner city hospital in Chicago in the late 90s. There was one patient that I took care of who had gotten beat up pretty badly.
When Maya Anderson remembers caring for this man, two things really stick out. One, the severity of his injuries. And two, the only thing she could do about it was to call the police on the police.
And he was dropped off at the ED by police. And I was his nurse. And it was so bad. He had serious injuries. And I asked him who did it to him. And he said to me very candidly, "The police beat me up." The police officer that came was really kind of cavalier about the incident. I said, "You know, this person has serious injuries. He's in surgery. I'm not sure what the process is." And he just said, "Well, we can't do anything until we can talk to the patient." And he made some reference to the fact that he was from the lower echelon of society and then left. And I remember just being very angry for the patient and angry in how it was addressed.
A few months later, Maya caught a news story about police brutality happening at a nearby hospital.
They actually caught on surveillance camera the patient was handcuffed to a wheelchair and he was beat by law enforcement in the waiting room of an emergency room. Patients who present in custody are considered criminals. It's not aligned with the nursing code of ethics.
Maya and a colleague went on to write an editorial for the American Journal of Nursing. They argued that these survivors should have the same care as survivors of other forms of violence, like sexual assault, who often get referrals for follow-up services that aren't strictly medical, legal support, mental health counseling, and so on.
What it said was, we need to work together. Nursing as a profession needs to band with law enforcement to develop a model of care for these patients so that they have access to the same resources that other victims of violence do.
Research suggests tens of thousands of people survive trauma inflicted by law enforcement every year. When I asked about the need for this protocol, wondering why it didn't already exist, Maya told me about some of the patients she's cared for and seeing some fellow nurses exhibit bias toward them.
I think it goes back to having or providing opportunities for populations that are historically or traditionally underrepresented in nursing or in healthcare to become nurses or healthcare providers because it gives you a different perspective in how you engage patients. And that's the perspective that I brought.
Some of the editors push back on this traditionally underrepresented perspective, recommending a lot of changes that Maya and her colleague didn't want to make.
Our response back was, just what you're saying indicates that you have no understanding of treating these patients like they're patients versus criminals, and this is why this editorial needs to be published. That was an eye-opener for me, even back then.
That was decades ago, and not much has changed when it comes to having a consistent, effective protocol for caring for people after an interaction with law enforcement. As far as I can tell, after contacting more than 36 medical and healthcare adjacent organizations, plus individual researchers and medical professionals. This is Obscured, the podcast from Kuvenda Media about critical issues that don't get much attention because they're complex, overshadowed, and happen largely out of the public eye. I'm Emily Previty. Fatal police encounters have understandably and deservedly captured our attention. But in this episode, we focus on survivors of law enforcement trauma and how they don't get the kind of support that's available to survivors of other forms of trauma. We'll explore the potential path forward to supporting law enforcement trauma survivors and unpack the obstacles getting in the way. One day, Maya was back to school shopping with her daughter when she was pulled over in a rural area.
You know, when I pulled off, I was irritated. The police officer was irritated.
This simple traffic stop escalated after the same cop pulled Maya over a second time, immediately after the first.
I was pulled over again about a mile and a half up the road, maybe 2 miles. And she pulled her gun, told me to get out of the car. I was under arrest for fleeing and eluding. And my child was in the car.
As all of this was happening, Maya couldn't stop thinking about another news story, about Chicago police shooting a woman after pulling her over.
The officer was standing at my door side with her gun drawn at my head and telling me to get out of the car. I was under arrest. I remember looking at my daughter and I said, you know, whatever you do, do not get out of this car. I remember being transported to the police station in handcuffs. And then she was booking me. She threatened to have my child taken away if I didn't get somebody to come get her.
Maya called her mother to come pick up her daughter. Meanwhile, the arresting officer took Maya's fingerprints and mugshot.
This is harder than I thought it would be because it's so far in my peripheral vision. But I think just thinking about it still, just I was angry, but my biggest concerns were for my daughter's safety and that she not be hurt.
After about 40 minutes, the sergeant in charge told Maya she could go home.
The sergeant said to me, looks like it was a personality issue. We're not going to arrest you. I made it home that night. I made it home alive. There were no charges filed. There's no person, no matter what your profession, that should have that sort of power to be able to destroy lives just because you're having a bad day.
That was about 2 decades ago. And since then, police misconduct has been a major influence in Maya's professional life. And for her, as with other similarly focused advocates and researchers, the pushback they encounter hits especially hard. Maya has been working on this issue with several nurses from all over the U.S. and one from Canada. They've been working on a paper about the need for a model for caring for law enforcement trauma survivors. Progress has been slow. When we first talked, Maya was confident this paper would be published in a matter of months, but that hasn't happened, and it's been more than 2 years. They recently found an editor and are hoping for a different result with this person's help. They've also secured a few grants. One included working with the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, to add questions about law enforcement interactions to one of its surveys. These developments are confirming and meaningful, but it's a long road. For example, that NIH survey we mentioned, about 2 years of research and preparation has to happen to even consider adding questions about law enforcement interactions. This road also seems more arduous than necessary, and not just for Maya.
Oh my gosh, you don't know how many times I'm like, I should have just done like diabetes research and I would have been okay.
Leslie Salas Hernandez is a senior researcher at the Center for Policing Equity, founded at UCLA, not too far from Leslie's hometown of Inglewood, California. Leslie has been with the center about a year since finishing her doctorate. She says she pretty much has her dream job, and it almost didn't happen.
My first few years of my PhD program, I was told that I was biased against police and that over-policing isn't a word, the prison industrial complex isn't a word, that I need to like have real definitions and have real words and just all these macro and microaggressions that I questioned my own intelligence. I questioned whether this was even a worthy research topic. The ideas that I had were knocked down, like that's not good science. And these are just like really brilliant people that you thought knew more than you. And so I honestly believed I didn't deserve to be there. I mean, there was a point in time where I didn't think I would finish the program.
But Leslie did finish, completing her PhD with a dissertation focused on this topic she's so passionate about.
Academia can be a really difficult place, period. And then it's just much more difficult for certain people, whether you have a disability or you are a Black scholar, or you're a person of color, for scholars that don't necessarily look a certain way or think a certain way. It's like, because I have experience with these things, I'm not able to be objective.
Leslie told me about a particularly traumatic run-in with police just after her high school graduation.
A group of us had gone to like Denny's and we went to the park right next door to the Denny's. We were swinging on the swings and having a good old time. And the police cars come up. Within like 30 seconds, I'm looking down a barrel of a gun. He's like, show us your IDs. We're all nervous. We're all flustered. Like, there's two cop cars with their lights and guns are drawn, and he's waving his gun in front of me. He's patted me down, kept asking me where my drugs were. I'm like, I don't have drugs. We were completely sober. And I remember telling the police officer, I'm going to Berkeley. Like, I just graduated. I was salutatorian. That's back when I believed, quote unquote, education would save me. That man did not care. It was just a brown kid that didn't belong there. We were brown kids at the park. Yeah, after hours. You're not supposed to be there after hours. I get that. But just tell us to leave. Unfortunately, I have a ton of these types of stories.
Leslie says she got pushback from people in academia who just seemed like they couldn't relate.
It made people deeply uncomfortable that I was talking about police violence instead of saying, why was my experience different from Leslie's experience? Instead of sitting with that, it was like, no, your research is bad.
Leslie told me things turned around for her after she found a supportive mentor who drew a comparison that still really rings true for Leslie.
She said, would you ask the person that had experienced intimate partner violence to reflect on their positive experiences with their abuser? No, you would not. Like, that's not helpful.
We talked about Leslie's research in detail in the first episode of this series, and we'll put a link to the report in the show notes for this episode as well. Aside from the findings, we should take note of the data underlying her study. It came from a survey that another academic on her research team conducted. But data collection on law enforcement trauma survivors that's ongoing, consistent, and broadly representative tends to be extremely limited. That statistic from the top of the episode, that tens of thousands of Americans survive trauma inflicted by law enforcement every year, researchers derived that using the Consumer Product Safety Commission's National Electronic Injury Surveillance System. It draws from 66 hospitals that collectively are considered to be nationally representative. Still, that data set is limited to acute injuries. It also misses people who don't identify police as perpetrators, not to mention those who don't go to a hospital, which you can hear more about in episode 5. For more perspective, I reached out to Claire Kelling. Claire is an assistant professor of statistics at Carleton College in Minnesota. She recently organized a conference to bring together statisticians from around the U.S. working on police use of force. She says that's a relatively rare focus area in their field. I asked her about pushback she might have encountered or heard about in pursuing this research. She said the most common source of tension is the attempted balancing of access and accountability. That means the accountability desired by survivors, or really the public at large, and how for researchers, not only academics, but journalists and others, it can be challenging to balance that interest with forging a relationship with police, who have a stake in this too, and are the ones who facilitate access to records and data.
That's something that I'm super intentional about. I want to incorporate community perspectives into my research, but it's something that I would say is not universally done. There's definitely, I would say, a push to try to be both ethical and responsible in terms of engagement with the community, but it's hard to do that.
Claire says that another major challenge is that every law enforcement agency's data collection practices are different. For example, when I told her about Maya's work, she mentioned that some departments do include medical information in their use of force reports.
Whether a subject was injured, whether they were hospitalized, and even sometimes some details about the injuries. It's not super detailed and it's not across every police department, but there is some information there.
She told me there's hope for some standardization and consistency in the FBI's growing initiative to collect use of force data. But that might not yield results that are relevant, at least not in the near future, for researchers like Maya, who need to support, or inform, or advance their work using data that doesn't seem to exist at the moment. Claire says a potential solution might be working with a data center to access information that's not publicly available and possibly synthesizing it in new ways.
We've seen our profession hit hard over the years and coverage gaps widen as there are far fewer journalists working today than when we started out.
The result is stories are simply being missed, especially what we call obscured stories. They happen largely out of the public eye and involve critical issues that are complex and often overshadowed.
That's why we've launched Obscured, to help give these types of stories the attention they deserve.
We value high-impact journalism and its capacity to broaden knowledge, catalyze public scrutiny, drive accountability, and shift policy.
And we hope you do as well, and will please consider becoming a supporter of Obscured with a tax-deductible contribution before the year comes to a close.
Your year-end gift will help support our ongoing research, reporting, writing, editing, and audio production that's happening behind the scenes to create the first season of Obscured and our From Words to Weapons series. Contributions can be made online at cuvendamedia.com/support.
We're grateful for you taking time to listen to Obscured and wish you all the best for this holiday season.
As part of Obscured, we've been telling you about other podcasts you might like. Democracy Works delves into a unique aspect of democratic life each week, including voting rights, criminal justice, the free press, and much more. Listeners have described the show as thoughtful, insightful political discussion, and as a source of hope for American politics and the future of our country. Democracy Works is produced by the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State and WPSU, Central Pennsylvania's NPR station. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
As part of your holiday shopping, check out Mud Girl Studios for beautiful, handcrafted ceramic art and gifts. When you purchase a handmade piece from Mud Girl Studios or make a donation, you're helping at-risk and economically disadvantaged women to create functional ceramic art and earn supplemental income. For orders and to learn more, head online to mudgirlstudios.org, and you can find them on Instagram at Mud Girl Studios.
In the fall of 2023, Maya and some of her colleagues presented about developing the protocol to care for survivors of law enforcement trauma. The room was packed. More than 200 people filled out evaluations for this presentation, which also included those who viewed it online. I wasn't allowed to record that presentation, but did capture their appearance at a different conference the year before.
We know that our professional healthcare systems and associations have kind of spoken out by publishing statements that denounce racism, that denounce police violence, and are in support of reducing the prevalence of law enforcement violence through advocacy, education, legislation, and research. But we don't see things moving forward very quickly.
You're hearing nurse Jackie Kalari-Robinson present with Maya.
Law enforcement violence is a public health issue resulting in numerous adverse health outcomes, deaths, injuries, traumas, stress, which disproportionately impact communities of color.
Jackie and Maya went on to explain that when people experience traumatic interactions with law enforcement and end up in medical settings, those scenarios often showcase not only the institutionalized racism in both healthcare and the criminal justice system, but also the scarcity of support available to those survivors and their loved ones versus those who've survived other forms of trauma.
Devaluation, scapegoating, thinking that victims of law enforcement violence deserved whatever they got because they did not comply, and dehumanization, considering law enforcement violence towards patients as acceptable behavior.
At the second conference where I wasn't allowed to record, one person raised their hand to ask a question at the end. They wanted to know more about trends, geography, demographics, the data, basically.
People are asking for more. More information, more direction, asking for statistics, more study, more evidence, but we just don't have it.
Margaret Glambaki is a sexual assault nurse examiner from outside Detroit.
So a lot of times we're taking statistics and putting them together, but they're not actually one really good study.
Margaret also teaches college-level nursing courses and told me the better data is not only critical to developing the protocol, but also to getting buy-in, to integrate it into healthcare practice. Getting that data, the evidence, that requires research, which requires resources, mainly money. To Margaret, who is white, the model of care for law enforcement trauma survivors isn't further along, in part because power and influence and control over institutional momentum have been concentrated historically among people who aren't as affected by over-policing and its potential health consequences.
Most nurses are white middle-class women. So a lot of times those issues, nursing struggles being political. We have those debates all the time. Are we a political entity or are we a healthcare entity? How can you not be both?
Nurse researcher Jocelyn Anderson is based at the University of Arkansas in Little Rock.
There is a huge need for healthcare providers to be empowered to take leadership in those patients, getting access to care that is not enmeshed in those same perpetrators of that violence.
In other words, not just calling the police on the police.
As a forensic nurse, I've had the opportunity to take care of patients who have experienced different kinds of violence. A lot of that has been intimate partner violence or sexual violence.
Providers like Jocelyn rely on specialized training, guidelines, and certification from the Department of Justice, as well as organizations outside the government, including the International Association of Forensic Nurses, which sponsored the conference where Maya presented with Margaret and where I talked to them and Jocelyn.
When that patient comes in, we know what aspects of a physical exam should look like and how to make sure that when we're doing both medical care as well as any evidentiary pieces in that medical forensic exam in a trauma-informed and patient-centered way. I've certainly taken care of patients who did indicate that the perpetrator of the assault was a law enforcement officer. We did not have any specific protocols about how that would be handled any differently. In some ways, that's great. We don't want to single people out or hesitate around having quote-unquote special patients. But I also recognize like that means that if those patients had reported to law enforcement and it was a law enforcement officer, I can absolutely see how that could be really problematic.
Jocelyn says there's a lack of specialized interventions for general physical violence.
When we think about power and control and that a lot of violence in general is about power and control, even when we're looking at two 20-year-olds who got in a bar fight, but the difference in where that power lies is probably not as structurally in existence as it is when we're looking at folks who are sworn law enforcement officers, where like that power dynamic is really built into the fabric of our society.
The victims are completely dehumanized and just don't count.
Leah Forlenza is a nurse from Milwaukee, where she's lived her whole life.
I'm the trauma coordinator for two level four facilities in the city. I'm also a practicing SANE at another hospital system.
As a SANE, or a sexual assault nurse examiner and trauma coordinator, Leah's cared for many patients in police custody or who come in after an altercation with law enforcement. Like Maya, these formative experiences started early in Leah's career, as she told me over Zoom.
First time that I realized that there was no one speaking for these patients. I had a very young man who was in jail for a very long time, but for nonviolent stuff. And the first day that I was taking care of him, we knew that he was going to pass away. He had significant liver failure. He was not doing well.
Leah asked the cop how they could get in touch with the patient's mother so she could come to the hospital.
He looked at me as if I had asked him to write me a check for 10 grand. I mean, he was just like, what? That's not a thing. So I got another officer the next day because, you know, different shifts. I asked the same question. He wasn't as taken aback, but he certainly wasn't thinking it through in the way that I was. Day three comes.
This officer was more receptive still, and a few hours later, Leah's patient was unshackled and his mother was by his side, without a cop in the room at all.
There's a human element. Do you still see people as human even though they're in your custody? Are you trained well enough to understand what's available, what's appropriate, how to properly take care of folks? And I guess I saw the entire spectrum of that within the care of one single patient.
Leah has cared for survivors of all types of violence: elder abuse, sexual assault, child abuse, domestic violence. She documents her patients' experiences, photographing their injuries, interviewing them, and giving them medical exams. Often that's used as evidence. She is trained to pay attention and practiced at being really observant.
I would say 2/3 of the patients that I've cared of that were arrested out in the community have bumps, bruises, some visible sign that their arrest was more than them just turning around and having the cuffs placed. There's doubt in my mind about whether it had to go the way that it did. And I can say that because I've seen people be arrested in front of me in the emergency department. I've seen people tased in front of me in the emergency department.
Leah also says she sees bias in how some colleagues handle medical care after those situations unfold.
We have an empathy problem big time. I think that there's an automatic assumption that if somebody put their hands on you and it's a police officer, then you deserved it.
It's hospital policies, too. For example, at Leah's hospital, people who come in from jail or in police custody don't get patient satisfaction surveys. And she says there's a pressing need for a protocol for people who've been injured by the police.
We have a protocol for domestic violence. We have a protocol for sexual assault. We have a protocol for kids. Why don't we have a protocol for violence in this form?
When we talked at the conference, Leah felt like things could potentially finally move forward.
There's a nurse that I do work with. She's here, and she had 1,000 questions. And I think that's really important that even if people weren't thinking about it already, that sitting and listening to it in this space, it sparked questions rather than a negative response. The huge attendance, really, people know that something needs to change. And it hasn't showed up in the patient spaces yet, but it's going to. I think the potential is there now. Whereas before, it was a small group of us going, why don't we have this? Well, now this is our governing body. This is our organization. And now it's out there.
I also spoke to Jennifer Pierce Weeks, who's the head of IAFN, the International Association of Forensic Nurses.
There is a need for forensic nursing in general to examine the issue of law enforcement violence as it applies to the patients that we serve. Is there something we should be doing differently than we are? That's always worth examining. We've done that with other patient populations as well. Should we be examining and talking about those things as forensic nurses responding to them? Yes, we absolutely should.
Jen told me she hadn't gone to Maya's presentation, so I didn't ask her for feedback based on that. But I did ask her about how developing the protocol might help nurses and other medical professionals in an emergency room setting when addressing patients who come in after an altercation with police or while in custody. It seems like it could be useful to help nurses and even police themselves navigate what's often a close, ongoing relationship. These scenarios involving law enforcement trauma survivors could be particularly fraught for sexual assault and forensic nurses who collect evidence that law enforcement sometimes relies on later, not to mention the overlap in funding more broadly, with a lot of money flowing from the Department of Justice's Office on Violence Against Women.
There is this perception that somehow forensic nursing is an arm of law enforcement, that there is an alignment there that doesn't necessarily exist, or at least in nursing practice should not, because My practice as a nurse is separate and distinct from any relationship I may have with law enforcement who may come into my emergency department and law enforcement who I may be required to make a mandatory report to. I still have an obligation to the patient population I serve in providing their health care, and that is separate and distinct from any connection to law enforcement that may exist by virtue of the fact that a lot of the patients we see report their crimes to law enforcement. A lot of them don't, right? A lot of them will not interact with law enforcement.
Jen described how police and medical professionals also work together in a very intentionally integrated way.
When I'm functioning as a forensic nurse, I'm functioning in that role. When I'm sitting on a multidisciplinary team, typically there's a different goal there. And the goal is most often to make sure that in any given community where there's a multidisciplinary team, that the response to victims is victim-centered, trauma-informed, and that offenders can be held accountable.
To me, this explanation shows just how complicated the relationship can be and the potential benefit a protocol could bring. I've also heard as much from other nurses we spoke to for this series. As far as next steps, IAFN could ultimately help to develop a protocol or publish a position paper. Actually, Maya's first stop for publishing her paper was IAFN, but that's not happening. Here's Jen.
The board's opinion was it was not ready for publication by the organization. We also encouraged them, if they intended to pursue what they were looking at the academic level, that they should absolutely do that.
Maya told me she felt like the organization wanted too many changes. One thing Maya has emphasized to me during our conversations more than once is that she's not anti-cop. Her vision is to involve law enforcement along with other disciplines or professions such as the legal field, social work, mental health, and so on. And there are some related efforts out there that could inform her work, such as a toolkit for emergency medical providers navigating patient privacy amid police presence, and research on advocacy for gun violence survivors through a medical-legal partnership in Washington, D.C. that's interdisciplinary and serves people who've also endured law enforcement trauma. Back in Baltimore, Maya's just started her PhD program at Morgan State University.
Doctorate number two of D&T. But yes, so sociology or social justice.
I visited Maya at her office at Morgan State, which is one of the largest historically Black colleges and universities in the nation. She's still running Morgan's undergraduate and graduate nursing programs, having been instrumental in turning around the struggling undergrad program several years ago. Remember at the beginning of the episode when Maya spoke about creating opportunities to work in healthcare for people who'd bring traditionally underrepresented perspectives into a medical setting as a way to reduce bias toward patients in custody or after interactions with law enforcement? By helping to turn around Morgan's nursing program, expand it to include the graduate level, and launch a new effort to expose high schoolers to the field, she's done just that. During the many years since she first attempted to address this issue of caring for law enforcement trauma survivors by pursuing research that could yield a specific protocol.
When I finished my first doctorate back in 2003, you know, I was really focusing on disparities in healthcare. And as an ER nurse, I was starting to see victims of law enforcement violence come through the ER. And so the things that you're seeing that raise a concern that this is a population that needs to be addressed. And that was 25 years ago when I finished grad school. When I wanted to continue working on my terminal degree and I wanted this to become my research focus, I was very narrow. So I was looking at nursing and thinking, I want to do it in nursing, but couldn't find a research match anywhere. You need like people sit on your dissertation chair who are embedded in the work. I didn't think to look outside of nursing and other doctoral degrees or in other disciplines. And this is like the best fit. And I think the thing that really excites me is I'm here at Morgan and they support the work.
Maya's planning to work through Morgan State's Center for Urban Health Equity, in particular, where the university plans to invest money from a settlement in a lawsuit over the state of Maryland, chronically underfunding its HBCUs versus predominantly white institutions. The court awarded more than $500 million total for Morgan and three other schools. The last time we talked, it was a Friday night, and Maya was driving back from working a shift at the VA hospital. She told me how she recently connected with some of the researchers who did a survey on resident attitudes toward police as part of federal oversight of the Baltimore Police Department.
I'm excited. I think I was just in the right place at the right time, 20 years later, which is good.
Next time on Obscured, Dr. Divya Venkat talks about how law enforcement trauma shows up in her patients. Divya is co-founder and co-director at River, a healthcare program in Pittsburgh for people who are re-entering the community after being incarcerated. She's also cared for people while they're in jail throughout her time with the Allegheny Healthcare Network's Center for Inclusion Health. She talked about how she and her colleagues navigate patient mistrust in institutions, including the medical field, with my colleague Stephanie Marudis and me.
We have so many patients who have injuries from interactions with law enforcement who tell us that they're scared, that they don't like to see police officers, that they're really worried about just even interacting with a probation officer sometimes. It comes up very, very often. And it's alarming and it's sad. A lot of our patients have PTSD from interactions by being incarcerated, from interactions with law enforcement. So it is something we see often, and it's hard.
In the meantime, for more about Obscured and the rest of our work, keep up with us on social at Kuvenda Media. Obscured's From Words to Weapons series is produced by Kuvenda Media and mixed by Brad Linder. Our series was edited by Diane Hodson and fact-checked by Chelsea Zhu. Malik Calhoun composed the music for this episode and for the rest of the series. Special thanks to Eve Abrams for additional editorial support on this episode, to our fiscal sponsor, Media Alliance, and Obscured's founding supporters. You can help more people discover Obscured by leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app and sharing it with others who might be interested. Stephanie Marudis is Kuvenda Media's executive producer and Obscured's co-creator. And I'm Emily Previty, the executive editor and co-creator of Obscured. Thanks for listening.